Welcome to another episode of Kung Fu Conversations. I am a little bit giddy today. Not only do we have our first Wing Chun person on the show, but somebody that I have read and followed for my entire 25-year Wing Chun journey. The world-renowned and world-class classy gentleman, Sifu David Peterson. Sifu, thank you for taking the time to be on the show today.
Thank you very much. Very kind of you to invite me.
So, Sifu, we have a lot of practitioners from all over the world that listen to the show. And since you are the first Wing Chun person, just in case some of the Tai Chi guys, some of the Choi Li Foot guys, some of the Tong Bei guys have been sleeping and living under a rock and they don't know you, would you tell us your martial journey, Sifu?
Well, it began 50 years ago this year, actually.
Wow.
So, yeah, I've been in training, in regular training of one kind or another since 1973. I was a child of the Kung Fu boom era, the Chop Sucky period. Big fan of Bruce Lee, obviously, since the 60s, because on Australian television we got the Green Hornet and similar things. And one particular show was a Japanese black and white serial called The Samurai. And I got kind of all caught up in the Asian martial art buzz when I was about 6 or 7 years of age and went on from there. So I first did Shaolin Triumphal, Shaolin Kung Fu, under a teacher that had been trained with just a handful of students. And he was traveling down from Sydney to Melbourne, which is quite a journey. It's like going from, I guess, from New York to Chicago or something like that every time he wanted to run a class. Wow. So the training was a little bit intermittent, and he was a very slow, methodical instructor. So in the 2 or 3 years that I was with him, we didn't get too far. But at the same time, I was hanging out with friends who'd done other things, and we all wanted to learn Wing Chun because we all knew by then that Bruce Lee had done some Wing Chun. And it just went from there. I ended up with a guy who said he trained with Wong Tsin Leung and purported to be someone who'd spent more than a year with Wong Tsin Leung, but that turned out to be a different story in the end. But I followed that fella for just on 10 years. And ran 7 classes all around the city of Melbourne on his behalf, did all his advertising, answered all his phone calls, and after a period of time realized that every time we asked a question, we were told, oh, when you're ready, but when you're ready never came. Wow. And so I started realizing that maybe he didn't really have the goods. So I started researching where else I could learn the system properly. And my research led me to writing a letter to Wong Tsin Leung and ending up in Hong Kong. And I was with my Sifu Wong Tsin Leung since 1983 until, unfortunately, he passed away way too early in the beginning of 1997.
Wasn't he about 61, Sifu?
Yeah, he just turned 61. He was a very young man. Sadly, as I tell people with a sort of an irony, he learned 2 things from Grandmaster Ip Man. One was the great martial art of Wing Chun, but the other one was sadly how to smoke lots and lots of Camel non-filter cigarettes.
Mm, yeah.
And it was probably those cigarettes that caused us to lose him.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, I was thinking about that. I was talking to my own Sifu. I've been training under my Sifu, Sifu Herbert Mayer, and the Wong Q method since 1998. And this year would have been Wong Q's 100th birthday. And yeah. I think about what would these gentlemen think of, you know, where Wing Chun is now and the world of Chinese martial arts is now and where it might be going in the future. So yeah, that's one reason we have someone like yourself on the show. Cause we'd love to hear your, you know, not only your story, but your opinion on, you know, the state or the pulse of Chinese martial arts and things like that.
Yeah, it's interesting to ponder what they would think, actually, because personally I think the world of Wing Chun is, there are some highs and there are some lows, and there's a new generation who seem to think that if they've spent 10 minutes on YouTube or watched the Ip Man movies 4 or 5 times that they can set up a school and call themselves a grandmaster, and that was something that would never happen in the past and wouldn't have been tolerated anyway, but you've got all these wannabe third and fourth generation guys that are trying to say that they know more than the people that were actually there when it was all happening. And it's a sad state of affairs. that's why I keep plugging on. You know, I'm getting tired. I'm 67 years old, and you know, it's getting hard to even walk up the stairs to the training hall these days. But I keep plugging on because I'm trying to keep the old values alive and try to pass on my legacy as best I can.
Now, were you actually traveling to and spending some long periods of time in Hong Kong, or was Wang Shengliang also coming over to stay with you in Australia?
It was a bit of both. I would go there as often as my holiday time from my professional job would allow. Sometimes those holidays would be 2 weeks. Sometimes they would be 2 months, sometimes in between. So what I do is get on the plane, get to Hong Kong, train like a crazy person, then come back and train like a crazy person until the next time that I could go across. And on 5 separate occasions, I brought my Sifu to Australia, and he stayed in my house, and we spent many hours talking and discussing Wing Chun, doing a bit of hands-on practice. And also he would go to my classes that I was running in Melbourne and interact with my students. So we had a pretty good relationship because I could speak to him in his own language, whereas a lot of the other foreign students weren't able to do that. So not taking anything away from their skills, because some of them are damn good. But I still feel to this day that perhaps I got a slightly deeper idea of the system simply because I could communicate in Chinese with Sifu. And that helped me to understand things at a level where some people probably don't quite get it.
So did you pick up Chinese like before you had started interacting with Wang Shuliang, or was that something that you did in order to do that? Or,
well, my fascination with Asian culture and Asian martial arts had led me to take up Chinese anyway. Mm. So I already had a degree in Chinese by the time I went to Hong Kong.
Oh wow! Okay,
I spoke Mandarin quite fluently, and then once I was in Hong Kong, initially my sifu and I communicated through Mandarin and with a dictionary if necessary. And with the help of other students who spoke both English and Cantonese. But by and by, I picked up Cantonese, and I had a spoken command of Cantonese. I've never had a formal class in Cantonese, sitting in a classroom learning it, but I can get by in Cantonese quite well. So in the end, Sifu and I would communicate mostly in Cantonese. Mm.
That's awesome.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
It's just part of the passion, and you really want to learn something, you take every step you can to get there. Mm-hmm. And I was very motivated to try to learn the language. It was a big part of what I wanted to do.
What was a typical class like? I mean, you probably had varying degrees of what training with Sifu Wang Shengliang would have been like. But, you know, when you were in Hong Kong, let's say for the 2 month stints, what would a regular class of Wang Shengliang's school, what would that look like, Sifu?
It wasn't like the classes you see these days that are mostly formal classes with people lined up being instructed as a group to go through this action or that action or this drill or that drill. It was a lot more you get shown something briefly and then you're expected to go over in the corner and work on it like crazy. Mm. And at any time, there wouldn't be more than maybe, let's say, between 5 and 10 people in the room. It wasn't like the room was overflowing with people falling out into the hallway. There were people would come in when they could get away from work or school, train for a little while, then leave. Others would then come in and take their place. As a visitor, I was there the full amount of time that the doors were open. And even when Sifu went off to dinner, I was still training. You know, I would just keep guzzling water or have a snack in my bag, and I'd keep training, whether it was just me and one or two other guys, or just by myself until he came back, because I knew that my time there at those visits was limited, so I wanted to maximize it. But there was nothing like a formal class where everybody lined up and was shown what to do. But what would happen is Sifu might see something being done and realize there's a mistake being made, and he'd come over and he'd stop us and he'd show us a better way to do it. Or he'd watch people training and say, okay, let's discuss blah, 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 whatever it might be. And he then started a little mini workshop, and we just drilled something, and he'd show us a way to train it. And at least once a month or so, he would set up a date. It was usually a Thursday night, but not always, but usually a Thursday night. And he'd say, on this night, I'm going to talk about, let's say, for example, Siu Nim Tao, the first form, or Chum Kil, the second form, or we're going to discuss something about the wooden dummy, et cetera. And on that night, those who were really keen would come in and he'd basically get the chalkboard out and he'd start breaking the system down and explaining the moves and the science behind it. So we got this little bit of formal instruction and a lot of informal instruction, and mostly it was interaction with your training brothers and sisters. So someone would just come up to you and say, let's do chisel, or let's do paksa, or let's do whatever it is. And you do it until you were tired, and then you go back in front of the mirror and do the form, or go back to the wall bag and punch the wall bag, or go back to the dummy and hit the dummy, or whatever you wanted to do. It was a very self-motivated type of training. Nobody made you do it. If you sat down and just watched, no one's going to say, come and get up and train. They'll let you sit down and watch, because that was your issue. That was not their issue.
Wow. Wow. It sounds like it was almost an individual's journey with how much you were going to get out of the system. It seemed like it was a lot on the individual's shoulders.
Yeah, very much so, which is quite different to the way most schools are run these days. I try to strike a balance between what I call traditional training, or we call it Hong Kong-style training, which is the way we learn in Hong Kong, as I described, and the more modern guided approach. Because as a trained school teacher, I was a teacher in private schools in Melbourne for 31 years, so I know how to teach. That's my profession, or at least it was. So I try to strike a balance between guided instruction and self-motivated instruction. And if we can find the blend between the two, you usually get the best results. The students need to be able to, it's like that story that was, Bruce Lee was quoted saying it sometimes, and other people have said it. You know, I can, if I'm a fisherman, I can get you a fish every day, and you have to come to me for a meal every day, or I can teach you how to fish and then you can make your own meal. I'm trying to get the students to the point where they can do their own fishing.
Very much so. Very much so. It's funny because you bring that up, and I was just going to ask, you know, what are some of the different things in your modern methodology of teaching that you did differently than, you know, maybe Wong Shun Leung did? And that sounds like you just answered it. Is there anything else? You've mentioned a lot in the interviews that I've heard and listened to you speak, Sifu, that you've tried to keep at least the mechanics of what Wong Shun Leung taught you, as far as the forms go, as far as the drills go, and things like that. Have you mutated or changed anything like that, or have you kept it pretty much?
I've kept it pretty much as it was shown to me, because I think if it works, why change it? You know, we have an expression in Australia: if it's not broken, don't fix it.
Absolutely.
So I've kept it very much the same as it was shown to me. I explain it the way it was explained to me, and I demonstrate it the way it was demonstrated to me. But I'm also aware that not everybody's the same. And like my Sifu, he would modify things or bend things a little bit to suit an individual who was having difficulty one way or another. Classic examples, there's my very well-known Kung Fu senior brother, Philip Bayer in Germany, who had an accident and lost a hand.
Yes.
Every other instructor turned him away. Wong Chin Leung said, come in, let's get started. And he found a way to help Philip to learn, even though he had that handicap of not having a hand on one side of his body. I have a student in Melbourne, Terry Hayden. Terry lost his leg in a boating accident many, many years ago. And when Sifu came across, we were already training with Terry, and he was quite good. But Sifu had a word in his ear, and all of a sudden he found a better way to try to move with his impediment. So Sifu was like that. He was quite the genius. He could help people and figure out how to use their body in a way that suited them. And so I try to be as aware as he was of people's individual needs and see what I can do to help them. And I will confess that there are a couple of ideas within perhaps, let's say, the wooden dummy or in training chisel or something like that, where I've shown my students something that's a little bit different, not to throw away what we've had before, but to say, here is an alternative which you can use if it suits you. I'm not saying this is Wong Shun Leung's way. It's something that I've found. It might work for you. It might not. Consider it. Don't throw it away straight away. But if you don't like it, if it doesn't work for you, then don't use it. So I think everybody brings something to the table. I just try very hard not to bring anything extra that it doesn't need to be there. So generally speaking, I'm fairly confident that what I show my students is pretty close to what I was shown, as close as possible. And as a result, that's how I apparently got the nickname, the Blueprint of Wing Chun. I didn't come up with that one. The other people came up with that one. And according to a couple of accounts that I've heard, I wasn't there when it was said, that when Sifu was asked by a couple of different visitors at different times, including correspondence he had through an intermediary with Jesse Glover, the late Jesse Glover, who's a dear friend and a mentor of sorts, he was told by Wong Sun Leung that of all the foreign students, David Peterson shows it the most accurate. So that was quite a proud moment for me to hear. I didn't learn any of that until after Sifu died. Because like a typical Chinese father, they don't tell you that they're proud of you. They tell everybody else they're proud of you, but they never tell you. And it was kind of a bit of a shock and also a revelation to learn that he felt that way. So that was kind of nice.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That is a compliment. Wow. Yeah.
So as a result of those conversations, the rumors started going around about what I could show people, and that's how they invented the term that I was the so-called blueprint of Wing Chun, of Wong Sun Leung Wing Chun, which is a nice compliment, but it's a big thing to live up to.
Right.
You know, I can tell you, you're putting out right now some YouTube and also on Instagram video content on looking at one specific skill, or, you know, maybe a little bit of Sunam Tao or maybe a little bit of this. And I'm finding that to be absolutely dynamite. One of the things, so I'm what, my Sifu calls his representative. So I don't have a Sifu status, but I've been training with him for 25 years. And there's a few little things here and there that I don't have, with the system, but I've got the three unarmed forms. I've got a lot of drill sets from Sifu, the weapons, the mokjong, and a few other things. But it's interesting because one of the videos that really stuck out to me, we have a different term for it, but it's not the terminology that's important. It was the lesson that was being taught, was the opening hands. We refer to those as hoisek, but you were explaining that this is a depth gauge, a measurement gauge. And I, you're the only person that I've ever seen explain that. And I find that a lot of these little fine details that seem little, but as you get further down the road in your training, if you don't have that microscopic detail, it becomes a semi-truck hole in the training process overall. And I wanted to thank you for those videos, because I think what you're doing there is fantastic work, and it's great too, because I get to see some things. I'm like, oh yeah, I've heard that, or I've seen that. And so I really love those videos. What made you decide to work on videos like that, Sifu?
That's all the brainchild of somebody that you probably know in the USA, a guy called Ronnie Chang, the comedian.
Yes. Yes.
Ronnie was my student in Melbourne for a number of years before he moved on and ended up in the US. And he still trains quite religiously in several martial arts, including his Wing Chun when he can. And he kept pestering me for years that I should start getting on Instagram, because I was never on Instagram until the last, I guess it's about the last 18 months or so. Yeah. And he just kept saying, you need to get on there, you need to get on there. And I kept saying, ah, oh, it's not my thing, it's not my thing. And eventually he even purchased the tripod and the sound gear and had it sent to me and pushed me to do it.
Good man, Ronnie. Good man, Ronnie.
And so because of Ronnie's pushing and a few other people, another fellow, one of my younger Wing Chun brothers in America, a fellow called Ho Lui, so shout out to Ho, he and Ronnie, between them, kept saying, you know, if you were to put out a little series of videos, just small chunks of information, enough to whet the appetite of someone who doesn't know, but also something to stimulate someone who's been doing it for years and thinks they know everything. And we decided on what we've ended up with now, which is these little 3.5 to 4 minute chunks. Sometimes we go a little bit over, but we try to keep it within 3.5 to 4 minutes. And we looked at a whole bunch of individual topics. And then we struck upon the idea, well, let's just look at the forms. And as it's turned out, we're now focusing very, very closely on Simmental on the first form. And at the rate we're going, it's going to be a while before we get through it. But it's a nice compliment to the DVD that I produced way back in 2008 or 2009 for Crane's production. It's like an update on that material. Plus, being in little chunks, you can digest it nice and slowly.
Absolutely.
And when we get through Sin and Tell, perhaps we'll go off and look at some other topics for a little while, and then we might tackle Chumkill in the same way and just keep moving through. It just depends how long I'm around for, because you never know. These days, you know, life can be taken away very quickly. So, but also with regard to what you said about the, we call it the Hoi Ma section, the opening of the stance, no credit goes to me for that. That's word for word everything Wong Sun said about it. I'm just regurgitating from the source. So it's not something I've come up with or something that I've invented.
Sure.
Or something I've just decided to talk about on the spot. That's the lesson as it was passed on to me. Because Sivu was very good at presenting in a formal situation as well. On the occasions where we did seminars and I was his translator, which made a big difference to my own understanding, because him and I would interact almost like Laurel and Hardy. Before the words were finished coming out of his mouth in Cantonese, I'm already explaining it to the assembled audience in English, because we're on the same wavelength. We had a very good rapport that way. And so I learned through those experiences how to deliver the information with the accuracy that he brought to the table. So those segments that you're watching on Instagram and Facebook each week and on YouTube, we just for the listeners and the viewers' information, every Sunday evening at 6 o'clock roughly about Malaysian time, we drop a new one on Instagram and it goes onto Facebook automatically. And then the Monday after that, we put up the last week's one so that I'm building up the library in YouTube. So the Instagram and Facebook is where you get it fresh, brand new. And when you want to go back and review it, the easiest place to find everything is on the YouTube page, which is our own dedicated YouTube page. So that's how it works.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Awesome. And I've got to work on that Malaysian time thing.
Never mind.
You've been also an excellent writer. You've put out a couple, two books now or one?
Yeah, two books. And I also helped Eric Lilio with the writing of the Gong Sao Wong book.
Sao Wong.
There's a lot of me in there, but Eric's the main driver behind it. A lot of my photographs are in there because, sadly, a lot of the students, just to digress, a lot of the students from my generation, the first generation, didn't have much in the way of photographs for Sifu because their attitude was, oh, he's always going to be here. I'll get photos later. And then he wasn't. But right. People like myself and, again, my Sihing's Philip Bayer, we really valued the time that we had with Sifu and we wanted to make sure we had the memories. So we kept a fairly good collection of video and photographic references of what we did. And because of us, now there's a lot of material around on the internet because no one else has that material. So with the Gong Sao Wong book, if you go through with a fine-tooth comb, you'll see a lot of the photos are actually credited to me because the other people sadly didn't have photos themselves. So, yes, I've been behind two books. My first book I self-published in, I think it was 2001. I did that because after my first invitation to travel to the United States by Sifu Jesse Glover, after delivering seminars in Los Angeles at Sifu Hawkins Chong's school and then in Seattle at the school of James DeMille, who's also passed on, I came back with a kind of renewed confidence that I knew what I was talking about at last. I never felt that way before. And I also felt a big debt to my Sifu that I had to pay it back somehow. So that's what prompted me to come up with my first edition of my original book, Beyond the Pointing Finger, Look Beyond the Pointing Finger. With the pressure, I guess, the friendly pressure of Crane's Productions and the guys there, they pushed me to do a rewrite of that book and expand it. And that was the soft cover one that came out a few years later, which a lot of people apparently now have copies of, which I'm thankful for. And then just after I came to Malaysia, we produced the hardcover special edition version of that one, which is the most up-to-date version. And then I still consider that still my first book. That's the same book. It's just been expanded and added to and made more comprehensive. it's essentially my Sifu's own words, and I expand on what he's saying and clarify what he meant by what he was saying. But it's essentially, it's Wong Sinlin talking to the audience, saying, this is what Wing Chun is from my perspective. A few years down the track, Eric Lillior from Wing Chun Illustrated Magazine gave me a bit of a prod and convinced me to write a second book based on all the articles that I'd already been writing in my column for Wing Chun Illustrated Magazine. So I took a lot of the articles, a lot of the column articles that I'd already done, and expanded them, pushed them out much, much bigger, put more detail. Because, of course, in the magazine, you got three pages and you have to say everything you need to say in right. three pages, which doesn't allow you to say everything at all. So you have to cut corners. But with this opportunity, I was able to take those chapters and say as much as I wanted to say about a particular topic involved. And so that became the second book, the WSLVT book, the Wong Sinlin, Wing Chun, Kun Hop. I think the full title is an overview in the form of essays. And that's got historical components. It's got photographic components. It looks at technicalities. It looks at drills. Basically, I try to look at everything in as much detail as I could. So yeah, that's what I've done so far. Plus, I don't know how many articles I've written in the International Martial Arts Press. It started in 1988 and it just went from there. So on my desk at one of my schools here in Malaysia, my main school in Seremban, I've got on the desk every time we open the doors, there's three folders that contain most of what I've written. And they're three folders that are about this thick. I've lost count of how many articles I've done and interviews that I've done, but there's been a bunch of them. So I've been very lucky. I've been given opportunities that would never have come to me had I not been involved with my Sifu and practiced his martial arts. So like I've said recently in another interview that I've done for a documentary that's coming up sometime next year about Grandmaster Ip Man and the history of the system, if it hadn't been for Wing Chun, then my life would have taken a very different direction and probably would have been very boring. So the majority of the cool things I've done, the great people I've met, the places I've visited, the opportunities that I've had, 99% of it is from Wing Chun. As simple as that. So it's a big thank you to my Sifu because he made that all possible. The only part that I regret is that we lost him along the journey because it would have been cool if he was still around. But then if he was still around, I probably wouldn't have been pushed to do all this. So it's a catch 22.
Right.
Right. Wow. You mentioned that after you taught the seminars in California and then up in Seattle, that you felt pretty good about what you were teaching. Now, you came from a background of a teacher and an educator. When you went into your Wing Chun journey, were you always wanting to be a teacher of Wing Chun or more of a practitioner that wound up transitioning over to the teacher's role?
Very much the second. I just wanted to learn. I wanted to be really good at Kung Fu and get as far into this whatever system I was training as I could. So I dabbled in several different systems over the years. The longest time spent was, apart from Wing Chun, was in Hong Kun and in Tai Chi. And I actually dabbled in both the Yang system and the Chun system of Tai Chi. And I have a reasonably good understanding of how they work, but I would never call myself any kind of expert on either one. Wing Chun is my thing. That's where I feel I know the most and I can do the best job. But in terms of my goal was never to be a teacher. I almost became a teacher by accident. Mm. Various things happened that pushed me into that role. And that's just where the journey took me and is still taking me. So unlike, again, I refer to the current generation, there's a lot of people now who they want to train for a week and open a franchise of schools the week after. And I get so many inquiries from various places around the world. I won't say where because it might reflect badly on different people. But so many people say, I'll come to your school for a week and then I'll go back and open schools in your name in my country. Or you come to my country and do a few seminars and then we'll open schools and we'll put your name on it. And I just say every time, not interested.
Yeah.
Because if you're not prepared to train for a length of time, you're not going to have enough skill and enough background information to be able to be anybody's teacher, let alone be good yourself. But there's this modern attitude of, I want it now. It's got to be a quick fix. It's too much internet thinking. Now press the button, got a result. That's not how Kung Fu works. The term Kung Fu, translated in its most broad sense, is a skill created through effort and time. It's an achievement that you get because you worked at it for a long time and you sweated and you bruised and you bled to get it. And anybody who thinks differently just doesn't get it. But I'm old fashioned. Everyone says, oh, you're old school. Old school is the way to learn it. The modern way is not going to work. You can't plug yourself in like Keanu Reeves in The Matrix. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. It's funny because, you know, you think about that and you look at, let's take a different profession. You know, you look at a professional piano player, you know, are you wanting to listen to somebody that practices for an hour once a week or somebody that dedicates an hour or two every day? That's the person that you want to hear and pay your money to play that piano because they have developed a skill over a long period of time. And for some reason, I agreed with you. I think, you know, in the world of martial arts, there are the weekend warriors that feel like they can take that seminar and in 20 hours understand what an entire system is. And that just, that doesn't make any sense. If you say it in a different context, you just move it over here a little bit and you present it something like that way. It's like, you know, have you spent thousands, not tens of hours, but thousands of hours and years doing the same process and going deeper and deeper into that? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That was well said, Sifu. Thank you.
Yeah, I always think that it has to do a lot with the intellectualization of things these days. As people think, well, intellectually, I may understand the concepts of a martial art or something like that, but actually physically putting it in your body and translating those concepts into something you can interact with somebody else, that's a whole different thing. It's very, very different. I was going to ask you, you know, with your teaching background, how do you think that's informed? I know you had said you work on this sort of idea of balance a little bit, but is there any other ways that may have informed your current teaching? And then maybe how has your teaching evolved over over time?
Well, the first thing that probably makes a big difference being a trained teacher is that excuse me, you can find the links between things and work through a pattern of movement that will take a student from one point to another with a clear journey, not just haphazardly, oh, let's do a front kick, now let's do a back fist, now let's do this, let's do that. It's a system of martial arts. It's not a style. So Wing Chun works because everything connects. So I can start the class with, let's say I'll start with a simple punch step drill of some kind, but in my mind, that can take me to a whole different journey for the student on that particular occasion. And so because I'm a trained teacher, I can see the links between one idea and another. And so what starts off as a simple idea becomes a really fulfilling and complex set of practices over a period of 2 hours or 3 hours. And the students end up going home going, wow, that really worked. I got that. It all makes sense. And they start to see how all the individual pieces along the way are required to bring together to make the system work. If you're not trained as a teacher, you'll tend to just pluck things out of the air. But teachers go through, most teachers, if you know anybody who is a teacher or if you've ever been a teacher and trained to be one, there's a thing called lesson plans.
Absolutely.
And teachers in training hate lesson plans. And the lecturers always insist that you have this and that and the other always in the lesson plans, and they tear you to pieces if you don't have all the pieces within the plan. But the thing is, by doing that over a number of years, physically writing it down, eventually you do that in your head and you actually walk in the door already having a fair idea where you're going to go. But also because you're trained, you have the flexibility to be able to change it if the class structure is not exactly what you thought it was going to be. So you might walk in the door thinking, oh, all my seniors will be there tonight. We'll do this because that's cool. And then you've got three new people in the room. You can't do that stuff anymore, but that's you still find a way where you take care of everybody's needs. And trained teaching gives you that ability. If you're not a trained teacher, you walk in and go, oh, damn, what do I do now? And you'll be trying to figure out what the class is going to be doing. I see the class, think, okay, I know what I'm going to do. Bang, just go there. And even within the lesson, it may evolve differently to what you had in your mind. Because a question from a student or a problem a particular student or a pair of students is having can redirect the entire session to everybody's benefit, because it highlights a problem that other people might have but don't realize they have, or never came across it and questioned it before. So every lesson needs to be flexible and flowing. It's a little bit like the be water, my friend, you know, idea. Got to be able to go with the flow, but stick to the ingredients. Always keep the ingredients correct, but modify the recipe if you have to.
That's awesome.
That's fantastic. Awesome.